I remember Paul saying, you know, because to get the actors, we look to the actor's book, the spotlight or whatever. Oh, we need someone like that, someone like that. And we needed the large lady as my auntie, because I was going to play this person with his auntie. And before we all met to get on the bus, actually, he was on the bus, and we met it in some country road somewhere. And John and I went to pick up George, and we met the bus, but Paul jumped off the bus, and he said, I got to tell you one thing about your auntie. Well, what's that? She stinks. Do you want to go on with this? So, well, let's see what it's like.
For a magical mystery tour, he knows what to expect. We guarantee him the trip of a lifetime, and that's just what he gets, the incredible magical mystery tour.
That Lennonish ticket agent who opens the proceedings.
Yes.
Have you ever thought that, you know, roll up? I know it's all like, come on, come along, let's all go on the mystery tour, roll up for the mystery tour. Mm-hmm. But have you ever thought of it as also maybe a bit of an in-joke, roll up, like, you know, as we'd say in England, skin up for, you know, roll a joint?
Have you asked any of your head friends if that means that?
No, we were just too stoned to discuss it.
Well, then maybe you've just answered your own question. I never had that connotation, but, you know, feel free. If they'd made it in 65, I never would have doubted it. But, you know,
but just the way you just roll up, you know, the Beatles singing roll up, did that never occur to them? I doubt it.
Well, in 68, it would have been shoot up. Shoot up for the mystery tour.
Snort up.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So we're going to discuss the making of and production of the Magical Mystery Tour film, not the music.
Yeah.
As something that aired in Britain, was premiered in Boxing Day 1967.
Yes, the day after Christmas.
Yes, which, why not, okay, set the scene for Boxing Day to, I think some Americans think they know what it means.
Yeah.
What really?
It's the day of the big hangover. You basically stuffed your guts, you know, eating and boozing on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
And then sort of Boxing Day is often the day of recovery, is the come down.
I relate it to the day after Thanksgiving in America, where you're going to be living on, you know, turkey leftovers and everything else that's still sitting around.
Right.
You don't want to move. You're pretty inert. You're basically parked around the TV.
Yeah.
You know, it's football in America or know, Sound of Music or, you know, some kind of.
Yeah, there'll be soccer in England, football.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the lowest common denominator entertainment that basically is meant to appeal to all ages and demographics.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So here come the Beatles with this head film.
It's just amazing.
Yeah.
When you said it that way, here come the Beatles. Oh, dear.
Now, There's a lot to unpack here in terms of, you know, what's been widely criticized as the Beatles' first creative catastrophe. Mm.
And well, certainly that was how... Unless you listen to Paul, who says that people like Spielberg have, you know...
Well, that's his hindsight defense of the thing. I also love the fact that, I mean, you get some great insight into his defensiveness about the thing where he, you know, justifies it by saying, well, it's the only place where you get to see the Beatles doing I Am the Walrus.
Right.
Fair
right.
enough.
Yeah.
But... really, to get into their heads in 1967 about what they thought they were doing and why they did it the way they did it is a very interesting thing to sort of make sense of it. Because, you know, here the Beatles, you know, had built their success on staying ahead of the curve, but not too far ahead of their audiences.
Right.
And so when you're talking about Mystery Tour as this disaster for them, I think there's two things you're talking about. I mean, the immediate thing was that you've got it as this mismatch of presentation. The product they delivered and the platform that they delivered it upon was a complete mismatch.
Yeah, I mean, there was no expectation of that end product, okay, on the part of the general public. If you think about the Beatles product they'd been hearing through 66, okay, yeah, you know, you have Tomorrow Never Knows and there's some clear sort of drug references, but it hasn't really gone full bore yet in terms of the Beatles' association with drugs.
No.
You know, that would be...
Although this is the year of the LSD admission.
Yeah.
So that would have been a clue to the new direction right there.
Well, absolutely, but...
You've got BBC banning A Day in the Life.
Yeah.
So, and over its purported drug connotations, right? Mm. Was that over the 4,000 holes?
Yes. And also, you know, I'd love to turn you on. That's a sort of sexual connotation.
So how does I Get High with a Little Help from My Friends slip under the radar?
They didn't ban it, but I think, you know, people sort of saying there are these references right through the record. And it had certainly made the news in Britain after Paul's admission.
Tyler and Carr were the ones that said it was pot plants on the cover of Pepper.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Not true.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... It is when you look in the context of things, so clearly the whole drug use thing is out of the bag now,
yeah.
right, as far as the public's concerned.
Yeah.
So if that isn't a tipping of the hand of what to expect with the Beatles' first self-created movie, I don't know what is. Although, as I said, given expectations for entertainment on Boxing Day.
Yeah, and also – you know, from the fans' perspective, they'd nearly made this Western movie, okay, A Talent for Loving.
Yeah, over a year before.
Been shelved. But were people really expecting this? And were the parental generation, you know, who, yes, some are already turning away from the Beatles because of these, you know, drug connections. But still, I just don't think people at that point in 67 were ready for this. Because I know that when The Prisoner started to air in Britain...
Mm-hmm.
Watched it on with my parents, and we were just baffled. You know, it was like, what the hell is this about?
Really?
It was kind of intriguing. We kept watching it.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, what is it? This is weird. This is strange.
You're describing the way Mystery Tour came off to a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly.
What is this? This is weird.
Yeah, this is weird. You know, it's like, this isn't the kind of humor we expect to see, you know, on Sunday night at London Palladium or,
right.
you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's that sort of mainstream thing you're being groomed for because that's the tradition.
Yeah.
And I don't think it would have been unreasonable for a lot of people in the tuning in audience to expect, well, the Beatles, it's Christmas time. Maybe they're going to do some holiday tunes or something like that. But it's going to be that funny, wacky Beatles sense of humor or something.
Now, that said, you know, had that been today and, of course, you know, in the context of our times, that there's some new product from the Beatles, people would just be lapping it up. But having rewatched the film in the last sort of several months, I have to say that it still falls down on many levels for me. I love watching it.
Yeah.
I love the musical sequences. I love the Beatles humor. I love some of the very British references there, you know, that are going on. This, you know, sort of coachload of people having a sing-song and going to see the lights. It's a sort of very British setting in that way. But a lot of it does falls flat. The filming, I know that this was Paul's idea of, you know, kind of just handheld cameras, almost like using your 8mm home movie camera and just seeing what develops.
It's an art film.
Yeah, I get all of that. But even then, you know, I think that if that was put on today for a mainstream audience, I'm still not sure how receptive the general public would be to it.
I kind of relate it to the way I would describe 8 Days a Week, where... knowing what the capabilities were, there could have been so much more made of it.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you know, one of the things that's like one of my pet fantasies, just like I see taking the extant footage of the Twickenham and Savile Row sessions and creating a documentary series about that, I would love them to see them take everything that we know exists of the cutting room floor clips from Magical Mystery Tour and creating a documentary about the making of an unscripted film.
Right.
That would be fascinating.
Yes, it would. Yes, it would. You see, I mean, that's the thing with the outtake footage. We've got plenty of it because, you know, and a lot of it was issued in the box set a few years ago.
Right.
You know, the DVD Blu-ray
release. But there needs to
be
some kind of cohesive framework to it to really understand, you know, in order how it all unfolded.
Yeah.
Because there's so much to talk about the production of the Magical Mystery Tour film. What was originally intended to be 2 weeks of filming, 2 weeks of editing, done in the entire month of September. Boom. Mm. You know, with the music was already being recorded along the way, and they were between filming shoots, they were, you know, working in the studio getting these tracks finished. So, but too many hands were involved in the editing. And their lack of experience in directing a film themselves was manifest because, you know, as they're presumably viewing the rushes in the editing stage, and it occurs to them, oh, my God, we have no insert shots of the bus from the outside going down the road.
Right.
It wasn't until very late in the process, I'm talking like the end of October, where they finally shoot Ringo and his Aunt Jessie arriving at the bus.
Anyway, I'll tell you something. You ain't coming away with me anymore.
Who bought the tickets for this trip? I did.
Yeah, with my money.
I bought
them. I gave
you
the money.
I'm taking you out. Yeah, you're not taking me anywhere.
I gave you the money, darling.
Remember that? And you've done nothing but eye all the fellas on the coach since we got here.
Shut your mouth.
I don't know. Since Uncle Jack died, you've never been the same.
Well, of course I ain't, because I ain't got Uncle Jack, have I?
Well,
so
I've got to
get somebody else, haven't I?
I remember him.
If I ain't got to get him, I've got to get somebody else, haven't I?
Well, I don't know.
You should know. You're old enough at 21.
Should do a bit of knitting, do you good.
For you.
Basic filmmaking 101. Mm. You know, you don't have to film it in sequential order,
right?
But you at least have to have your bases covered. And they're working from a pie chart.
The other thing is the lighting and camera work. Now, again, if you're going to run with that whole concept of pause, which is the sort of amateur home movie style of filmmaking, then stick with that.
Right.
But, you know, you can't do that and then have, well, I suppose you can, but I don't know if you can do it successfully, to switch between scenes where things go briefly out of focus. I know, like a Fall on the Hill sequence.
Yeah.
You know, there's a bit where just suddenly it goes out of focus and then comes back in as the cameraman adjusts the lens, and that's left in like that. And then you sort of put that next to the ending with Your Mother Should Know, where it's kind of their version of the Busby Berkeley big Hollywood ending.
Right.
Filmed in a plane hangar. You know?
And it just ends there. It just kind of comes out of nowhere off the strip club scene.
It's too, you see, that's the main thing about it for me is the concept is fine, but it's just way too disjointed.
Well, that's the thing. As I said at the onset, there's two things we're talking about. One is the presentation, which I think if they'd found the suitable platform, you know, Paul had aspirations very early on for it to be a theatrical release. Mm. And it could have been, you know, before such a concept existed, a midnight movie, and it would have been perfect. Yeah. And that's how it became later in the 70s and the 80s. When I first saw it, it was literally a midnight movie.
Yes.
And that is exactly the right audience for
because it was issued. When was it first shown in America?
It was canceled. Mm. It was supposed to be coming early 68, right off the heels of the British broadcast.
Yeah.
And they were talking $1 million on NBC.
Yeah.
Once the scathing reviews came out, they dropped it.
Yeah.
And that was that. And it only slipped out years later on the midnight movie circuit.
Right.
So it never got to
and when that was like kind of mid-70s, wasn't
it? Yeah, something like that, like maybe 74.
Because I've seen the trailer for the theatrical
release and I've
in
got
America.
The poster for it.
Yeah.
But it didn't make it to television, I think, till way later. By
right.
that time, everybody knew what it was. And
on a double bill with Broad Street by then, I suppose.
Well, Yellow Submarine. I mean, that's how I saw it. But it was one of these things that it become in circulation through these various gray market iterations of it. Mm. I've got a VHS tape of it from the 80s, but you know, it had come and gone. I think there was a laser disc, but in any event, there was never really a context for it being delivered in real time in America, at least, and barely one in Britain. Now, one of the things that I know is often discussed as a reason for its failure, they went to the trouble and expense of filming it in color.
Color.
Fair enough. And but they shot it on 16mm, number one, which is going to look like crap anyway.
Yes.
If you're dealing with TV, which they weren't sure at the time if it was going to be theatrical or TV, you know, they shot their promo films at Chiswick House.
I know, on 35mm. Yeah.
They should have just gone that extra mile because it would have looked fantastic. And keeping in mind the possibility of being a theatrical
release. But maybe
release.
That's what Paul wanted, though, right? The kind of home movie feel to it.
There is that. You can, I mean, I'm sure if you're trying to get him to justify himself, well, this is what I was going for. But the other thing is, okay, they wouldn't have known in advance as they're filming it whether the BBC was going to run it in black and white or color. Hmm. And it's been said, oh, you know, all this color and that the film is so hinged upon, you know, was lost when it was shown in black and white.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But they also had to realize that most of the households in Britain were watching on black and white
TV. Absolutely.
So if you're making this for television, don't hinge so much of its success on the color that most people won't see.
Yeah, but that flying sequence is absolutely meaningless.
Yes.
Yeah.
Those outtakes from Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah.
Those aerial shots in the clouds over mountains and stuff. Yeah. Beautiful shots. But
my first ever interview with anyone was Victor Spinetti back in 1980. And we will air parts of that on future shows. But I remember him saying with Mystery Tour that that flying sequence, what they were trying to say was, you know, if you look this way, you see, you know, ordinary
life. Not too inspiring.
Yeah, but if you look over here, you know, it's like think differently, see the world differently.
Yes.
And it's like, and here it is in black and white, and it's just lost all that meaning.
The world really is that gray. It's that sort of, you know, anticipating how it's going to be presented and therefore how that should shape what you were putting on the screen. There was that kind of thoughtfulness that was lacking in this thing because they're really going for this sort of on the fly, you know, let's let the magic happen by being open to the possibilities. So you've got that aspect in the actual film craft.
But that's a real sort of lacking. Acid mentality, isn't it? It's almost like...
Or cocaine mentality.
Yeah, but the acid one is that it's like take the pill and just let it happen, you know?
Yeah, and if you're watching the thing. But, you know, cocaine infuses you with, I can do anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, like the general public here haven't taken these hallucinogens.
Right. And so especially not on boxing.
Yeah. Right? So it's basically everyone's turning up straight at a party full of drunks.
Yes. Yeah. And missing the point of the thing and hence the whole blatant rubbish and all this other invective that was hurled at them.
Yeah.
It was just such a mismatch. Now, the more you look at it, you can sort of get where their intentions were noble enough.
Hmm.
You know, clearly the path that led us to Magical Mystery Tour from Help was they no longer wanted to be beholden at someone else's vision of the Beatles. And so they were going from this, you know, talent for loving, shades of personality up against it, all these other possibilities where they would not be playing versions of themselves.
Yeah.
They're getting out of the John, Paul, George, and Ringo comfort zone.
Yeah.
Fair enough. That's a very noble thing. Now, when they're undertaking this themselves, it's because they want to have the control of their own image. And you notice that in the film, you know, you don't hear the word Beatles. You know, it's always, you know, George is referred to at by name. Ringo, they call him Richard or Richie in the movie.
Yeah.
But you don't – they're never presented as Beatles.
Right.
You know, so they are
– Oh, yeah. This isn't A Hard Day's Night.
Not at all.
No,
definitely not. So they're sort of, representing versions of themselves, but under their own control.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that, you know, as much as John would slag it off retrospectively, all that was, you know, Paul's vision, Paul's master plan, you know, write a scene. What the hell does he mean, write a scene? I've never made a film before. Yeah.
Effing
you
know, Ada.
right. But you look at the film, the finished film, and, you know, it's all his scenes that really keep you captivated.
Yeah, but hold on. Look at the outtakes that are in the box set, okay? And what struck me, not just with John, we've got a whole scene there where kind of true to form, his big scene of directing is all these women in bathing suits by a swimming pool.
Self-serving.
Yeah, really. Yeah. But, you know, if I was watching George in those outtakes, right? And it's, you know, old George by then wants to be in India and he's not really into this.
Yeah.
You know what? He looks real happy all the way through
that
filming. What I've seen of George, he looks like he's into it and he's enthusiastic. I think it was, certainly it was Paul's baby. There's never been any dispute by any party that was the case. But I think it's just unfair how it was framed by, especially John. I wouldn't say George, but by John.
That they rammed it down his throat?
Yeah, kind of thing.
No, and there's a hindsight thing. If it had gotten lauded, if it had gotten the acclaim of Pepper, they'd all be on board with it.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Yellow Submarine.
I'm sure Yoko would have played a part in inspiring it somehow.
Yeah, exactly. But when Yellow Submarine came out and they finally got to see the finished thing that they'd been distancing themselves from all the while, they were like, wow, this is good. How come we weren't more involved? So it really is their perceptions being colored by the great slamming that it got.
I mean, with 2020 hindsight, what I would have liked to have seen, you know, now having seen what the result was, is to have absolutely the Beatles be fashioning a script, but with a professional scriptwriter who mm-hmm. can shape it and put it into a proper professional finished form.
Give it some bones.
Yeah, even if there's a lot of improvising, it's fine, but at least you can have the Beatles input, have, you know, professionals in charge of direction, production, and also the filming. I mean, Ringo, Richard Starkey, MBE,
yeah.
gets credited as director of photography. I'm not sure that's anything to boast about.
Exactly.
On that film.
Yeah, all the quick cutting, the zooming in and out,
yeah.
all this you know, Blair Witch stuff that makes you sick the first time you watch
yeah.
it. Yeah, I'm not sure that's quite the feather in his cap.
And the editing, right? The scene when they're just racing around that track.
Yeah.
It just goes
on. The marathon.
On. Yeah, it just goes on and on. It's like, what were they thinking? I know they weren't making it specifically for Boxing Day entertainment,
mm-hmm.
but that's how it aired. And, you know, you just got these scenes where you can just see people turning off or getting up and walking away.
Well, the thing is, it's noble enough to want to create, you know, this bare bones framework and then let the stuff be improvised along the way. Mm. Fair enough. There's plenty of filmmakers and directors that work that way. You know, of the cast that they brought in, the one who was adept at that, who, you know, had much experience in that, was Victor Spinetti.
Yeah.
And so he's got, because he's working on the biggest bundle of them all at the time, mm-hmm. with Raquel Welch, he's only able to give them a day.
Yeah.
And that's when he does the recruiting office army sequence where he's just shouting in gibberish.
Why? Why?
You love a boss on the boy. You love that buddy to come to start the road. Oh, they buddy love to come to start the day of all. It all might never got to start it. They will get your bloody
now that's him riffing off a character that he did in Oh, What a Lovely War.
Yeah.
So he had the chops to do that scene.
I feel so uncomfortable about the scene there with Paul, though, as the officer, because Victor's a professional actor.
Yeah.
And he knows how to play it dry and to play it for laughs. And you've got Paul just hamming it up, you know,
yeah.
jolly good and all that. And it's like, oh, please, you know, Paul trying to be the actor.
He's so outclassed.
Yeah.
And he had to have known it, but he, you know, he's game and wants to keep up.
It's absolutely fine, the Beatles looking amateurish as actors. You know, you get that in Hard Day's Night and Help. They're not actors. They never profess to be.
But keep them within the comfort zone, they could pull it off.
Yeah, and there's a charm to it, okay? You know, it's the boys next door in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But with Magical Mystery Tour, you know, there are just moments where it's just like they're switched off. Or hamming it up in a way that needs a director to kind of, again, pull in the reins.
Right, impose some order on the proceedings.
Yeah.
And they just lack that. You know, mm. you've got four credited directors.
Yeah.
And not to the credit of any of them.
No, and editing almost like in a competition with each other.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could have had four director's cuts of that film, each yeah. one of them different.
Yeah.
Now, of the casting, you've got Ivor Cutler,
mm-hmm.
who was this great, you know, sort of British personality with the Scottish background.
Yeah, and music hall guys, right?
Yeah.
That's what they did. They went through the Spotlight, which is the sort of directory in the UK. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and just picking talent from there.
And they'd seen him on late night TV.
Yeah.
So they knew that he was, you know, perfect for what they were doing. You know, Paul still has this idea in mind, having read about the, you know, the book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, had not come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
That came out in 68. But it was the account of the Ken Kesey, Merry Pranksters, you know, being loaded up on speed and pot and
yes.
acid, traveling from California to the New York World's Fair of 1964.
Yeah.
And all the hijinks along the way. And I've got Neil Cassidy and Wavy Gravy
right.
and all these eccentric characters on this bus.
Yeah.
So he gets that idea in his head. In it was April of 67 when he'd flown over to America, where Jane Asher was appearing on stage. He wanted to surprise her for her birthday.
Mm.
So it's on the way back
yeah.
that he gets the idea in his head of sort of imposing this counterculture, you know, that sort of mindset on the very British, traditional, mainstream, working-class charabanc.
Right. And I think that in itself is a great concept.
Yes.
It really is. And it's a sort of trippy era, and I get that. You mm-hmm. know, you can do it through that sort of hallucinogen lens.
Yeah, do this traditional framework and then build upon it of this. You know, I think it would have been contingent upon who you got in the cast, who's got that sort of improvisational background or skill set.
Can you imagine if they had, like, Peter Sellers?
Oh, my God.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly that. Spike Milligan?
Yes.
Those type of people.
Oh,
or even,
yeah.
you know, the up-and-comer, you know, Graham Chapman and John Cleese.
Yes.
Those type of people.
Yeah.
It would have been a wholly different movie that they'd be raving about to this day.
Yeah.
Instead, you know, you've got credited as Mandy Wheat. It was Miranda Forbes.
Yes.
You know, who was hired because of her bust size.
Yeah.
You know, as eye candy.
you got Fat Lady, which is
Jessie Robbins.
Jessie Robbins.
You know, who, you know, fair enough, I mean, she's an actress, but she's used to a script.
Right.
You know, she'd been seen in that year she did The Fearless Vampire Killers, the Roman Polanski film, where here's a remote Beatle tie for you folks. She played Sharon Tate's mother in that film.
Yeah.
So a traditional character actor, she'd worked on Benny Hill.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they thought, oh, well, if you work with Benny Hill, you'll be funny on command.
Right.
So they got her. They got Ivor Cutler, who was this poet, you know, sort of dry wit kind of guy.
Yeah.
Looked about 20 years older than he actually was. He was in his mid-40s as her romantic interest.
Right, right. You got Derek Royle,
who's
Jolly Jimmy Johnson.
Yeah. A former acrobat.
Right.
But he had the personality to pull off that role.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. So you got that. You've got Nat Jackley.
Yes.
The rubber man.
Yeah, another music hall favorite.
Yeah. You see him in the film with the Hitler mustache.
Right.
Again, you know, he was a known quantity from TV and such, but not really given much to do.
Hmm.
You know that they shot 10 hours worth of footage, cut it down to 52 minutes. They could have easily gotten 90 minutes out of what they filmed, I think, if you'd given these guys, you know, the spotlight to do their thing. You know, as it is, we see in the the Blu-ray extras, Jesse Robbins playing a drum solo, basically.
I know. And there's a wonderful part on there which we should play, actually, which is on the bus when they're all a few sheets to the wind, you know, been drinking and having a good time by the looks of
yes.
it. And they have a sing-song, as we'd say, you know, a sing-along. And,
apart from the one that's actually in the film?
Right, yeah, where you've got Aunt Jessie singing and you've got Magic Alex
taking the mic. Oh, she's doing that torch song, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Again, you've got this innate talent within the people you've assembled.
Blues Whaler.
Yeah. Instead of trying to make them into something they're not, which is improvisational, funny, you know, creating the magic on the fly thing, you know, you've got these people assembled. Let them run with whatever their talents are.
Right.
And you'd have something there.
Yes.
What part did you want to play right now?
I'd like to play a part of Jesse singing and Magic Alex taking the mic.
Oh, the lonely river calls upon the sea. Yes, it calls upon the sea.
That's probably the first thing I've ever seen out of Magic Alex where I kind of understood why he was around.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the part that we're missing. You know, we get his the grand visions for all his inventions and stuff and how utterly he failed.
Yeah.
Hence the word used in the New York Times to describe him that he got sued over.
Yes.
They got sued over. But now you're actually saying, okay, here's what this guy's appeal was.
Right.
And didn't make the final cut.
I mean, the visuals are wonderful because you can see he looks a little embarrassed. He feels a bit awkward, but he's doing it. And there he's got his mates, the Beatles,
right.
just backing him up.
You're actually getting what was sort of the whole purpose of the thing, which was unscripted, let the magic happen.
Yes.
Now, we also know in Newquay, where they had stayed at that hotel where they—
In Cornwall, yeah.
Yeah, where there was 3 nights they stayed there and used it as a base to film sort of ancillary scenes there.
Yes.
There was the night that Paul went off and went— basically he found a pub.
Mm.
And once he arrived there, they like sort of locked the door, and then he was there till 2 o'clock in the morning as the sort of pub pianist.
Yes.
And that— not a frame of that got filmed.
No.
And everybody was there and said, oh my God, it was the most wonderful thing. You know, got this whole room full of patrons drinking and singing every song. Although I guess pointedly he would not play Yellow Submarine, but everything else on earth.
Wonderful footage in the extras of the DVD Blu-ray release is in the hotel there in Newquay when they're having lunch around the table. And it's just interesting to see who sits with who. It's like John and George. I think Paul's with little Nicola. Mm-hmm. And you just see them kind of all interacting there around the table. And then there's a little bit of in-hotel entertainment that mm-hmm. you just see them. The Beatles are sitting back listening to sort of old-time entertainment there for them. And I think there's a bit with Nat Jackley as well doing his thing.
I think had they not been so determined to stick to the original concept of you're just going to let the magic happen, and 10 hours later, they're reduced to 52 minutes of what they thought was the best of the magic.
Yeah.
If they had fleshed it out a bit, not been so beholden to the schedule that they put themselves on, even though they blew through what originally had been budgeted to set aside time for this thing, they could have made something lasting and worthwhile that at least had a cohesiveness to it.
Yeah.
Put in some gap-filling scenes that sort of threaded the whole thing together.
I mean, a pre-planned scene is the one with the magicians, and it has its moments. John doing his queenish accent is kind of funny, but Paul, again, is way overacting. The parts with Mal look utterly sort of amateurish.
Mm.
And it just, again, doesn't hold together.
No, it's a little cringy. Let's play that.
The bus. It's 10 miles north on the Dewsbury Road. And they're having a lovely time.
They're having a lovely time! They're having a lovely time!
Could you tell me what's next on the agenda?
A song.
Not you.
Them.
It seems like Ringo is more in his element. Ringo and John.
Where's the bus?
Yeah, they're the ones that can kind of hold their own in these sort of fantasy characters kind of keep it going. But there's that self-consciousness about Paul that just doesn't make it. I think George knows enough when he's out of his element to, limit his input to the proceedings.
Well, George doesn't try too hard, does he? He doesn't push. Paul is trying to ham it up.
Yeah.
George isn't. George is always George.
Right. One of the first things that really kind of charmed me the first time I saw it was that scene on the bus with John and little Nicola. Now, that's the thing that if you know the backstory of how it happened, one of the most unscripted things of the entire proceedings, she wasn't even planned on being there.
Right.
What it was her aunt was somehow connected, I don't know if it was to the Beatles fan club or something, to where she was charged with finding extras for the film.
Yeah.
So she brought in her mother, who was Amy Smedley, and an older woman at the time, who then invites her daughter, who is Nicola's mother.
Hmm.
And the mother said, well, I'm not going to leave my kid alone. I'm going to bring 4-year-old Nicola along.
Yeah.
So she ends up on the bus.
Yeah.
And it was not a planned thing at all.
Right.
And so John, who is renowned for his non-parenting skills, suddenly when it's somebody else's kid, this completely, just captivating little vignette of him, with the Dickey Birds. I mean, let's play that because it's...
But also George, the way George is there in his dark glasses.
Yeah.
You can't see the eyes, but,
no.
But just sit there with a big-shouldered jacket.
Yeah.
And the two of them entertaining this kid, it is very charming.
Yes.
I've got a present for you. Do you know what it is?
No.
Have a guess.
No.
Go on, have a guess.
No.
Have a guess.
No.
Have a guess.
No.
Well, you're going to get it anyway. What's that? Wait a minute. Do you want to blow it?
No.
Right. Should we give it to George? There you are, George.
Thank you.
George, 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 oops, George, 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 George.
Funnily enough, Nicola Hale ended up in Chicago area.
Really?
Did you know that?
No.
And get this, her career, a drug counselor for people with substance abuse problems.
Oh, perfect.
Right?
She hung out with them as a kid. And,
yeah. And set their career path there. Yeah, so interesting. But it was her grandmother, Amy Smedley. They were the ones that owned the fish and chip shop.
Mm.
And I guess midway through those first 2 weeks, that's when the Beatles found out, oh, you guys have got a fish and chip stop in Somerset, I think it was. That was where they stopped off. And so that scene that made the outtakes when they reissued the film, them eating fish and chips, that's where that was.
Yeah. Although, well, we have bits of it in the I Am the Walrus sequence.
Yeah. Well, we also have what was in the booklet that accompanied the actual release of them eating their fish and chips.
Yes.
And that's where it's from, even though it's not actually in the film.
Right.
Just like the booklet in that little cartoonish story, there's stuff in there that did not make the finished film because they kind of sketched that out before things got filmed or did get filmed, didn't make the cut.
Now, you talking before about the casting for the film, that's the bit that always gets me is the pie chart that Paul drew up.
Yeah.
And on it, it's got midgets.
Right. Well, you know, you've got – it was at John's behest that they brought in Nat Jackley.
Right.
Who does all that freakish stuff.
Yeah.
It's funny that that kind of entertainment, I compared it to Ed Norton, Art Carney.
Yes.
Who does that very physical humor.
The rubber body, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is sort of a carry-on from – the guy in Singing in the Rain, Donald O'Connor.
Yeah.
Yeah, who does that sort of – there's a tradition.
And then
stuff.
You could even say, like, you know, coming more recently, someone like Rowan Atkinson, Mr. Bean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, you get to where that would be a nice addition to the cast, although you don't really see him do his thing in the film.
Well, that's the problem. They've hired people who can do their thing, and they are all charming in their own way.
Yeah.
But they could have done so much more.
They could have. Now – you've got Ivor Cutler, the aforementioned
Buster Blood Vessel.
Buster Blood Vessel, which is it's a cool
Buster,
little
Buster, not Bluster.
Buster, yeah, yeah. No, that's cool that they gave him, they allowed him that characterization.
Yeah.
And he's somebody that, you know, had the sort of deadpan humorous persona as seen on BBC. He'd been a school teacher by trade.
Yeah.
And so he actually is one of the few people besides Jesse Robbins who gets to shine in the film.
Yes.
And but there's so much more they could have done with him.
Well, what about this sequence? So this musical sequence that was cut from the film.
Yes.
That we got to see.
I Go
with
in a
the
Field.
Extras.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's play a little bit of that.
I'm going in a field. I'm going in a field. I'm going in a field to lie down. Yellow flower in the grass. Yellow flower in the grass. I'm going in a field. Field. I'm going in a field to lie down. My lover's eyes are blue. I'm going in a field to lie down.
Very British.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, it really adds to the sort of atmosphere of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why the hell they cut it out?
Yeah, I know. And then another sequence, which, yeah, it doesn't really gel with the film, but it might have pulled in a few more viewers, is with traffic. Here we go around the mulberry bush.
Yeah, which is very interesting. Again, another Beatle tie there. Okay, so this is their third single, right?
Yeah.
And they're ready right out of the box. You know, the Stevie Winwood who split from the Spencer Davis group.
Yes.
And Dave Mason, Jim Capaldi, Chris Wood. So they've got this great band formed. They've already had the success with Paper Sun that year.
Yes.
And anyway, so their third single. So I don't know if they're thinking, well, let's give these guys a boost as they would with the Bonzos or, you know, I don't know how it all played out. But so Here We Go Around the Mulberry Bush is their latest single, which ends up going top 10, but it's cut from the film. They filmed it for that. It ends up the following year being the theme song to that movie made based on a novel written by Hunter Davies.
Right.
The Beatles biographer.
Yeah.
So, again, this sort of small world of connections thing.
Yeah.
Let's play a song. I don't think it's gotten much airplay in the States, but it's a pretty good track.
Turn around every way
when they saw the final cut, they must have been disappointed, weren't in the film. When they saw the reviews, they were only grateful.
Right. To rescue their career. Yeah. So another what might have been that didn't end up in the film.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to look at the Beatles, who they were pulling together, and even if they didn't get used, it seemed like they had some good instincts.
Yes.
If not a real clear-cut idea of how to implement this.
Yeah.
I'd started to say before, you know, Nat Jackley, that being this sort of, you know, kind of freakish comic actor,
yeah.
It was, according to Paul, John's inspiration to get the – they initially called for 6 midget wrestlers.
Yes.
For that one scene shot at West Malling where it's sort of like a carnival.
Yeah, and they've got the tug of war, haven't they, the rope.
Yeah. Where the marathon is, and they've got the pipe organ playing She Loves You.
Yes, and the midgets are all bare-chested.
Yeah, they only got 4 they managed to get for the film. And so that's what they used, you know, on short demand. But
and one of them,
pun not intended.
You've got also World Cup Willie. You remember there's the bit where it's like someone dressed up as a lion, and he takes the photo of them.
Oh, it was that he was a midget.
Yeah. And World Cup Willie was the mascot for the English football team in 1966 when they won the World Cup. The tournament was staged in England, the soccer tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And World Cup Willie was the British mascot. So, you know.
Is that what that head was? That after he's beneath the cape taking the picture?
Correct.
So, okay. So people would understand
and
what
that is.
And
actually, Lonnie Donegan had a single about World Cup Willie.
Okay.
In 60. He still cashed in on it and had a song, World Cup Willie.
There's a football fella. You all know his name. And the papers tell us he's in the Hall of Fame. Wherever he goes, he'll be all the rage, 'cause he's the new sensation of the age.
Dressed in red, white and blue, he's World Cup Willie. We all love him too. World Cup Willie, he's tough as a lion and never will give up. That's why Willie is favourite for the cup.
England had won the World Cup for the first and so far only time in July of 66.
All right. So this is a year later, but people will recognize what that was.
Oh, yeah.
See, again, that's a reference that completely escapes an American audience.
Right.
But George Clayton was the guy who played the photographer.
Yeah.
And there's that sequence of him riding a tandem bike with Paul.
Yes, yes.
His sort of visual non sequitur.
But, I mean, you know, when you said that's an English or British reference that, you know, the rest of the world wouldn't get, I love that about the Beatles. They had that clout. And even from the beginning, actually, they weren't afraid to just be English. You know, they didn't have to go the American route,
right,
even though they were immersed in rock and roll.
Or even stay true to their Liverpudlianness, because you know, to be successful in show business, you had to like clean up your accent,
right,
and not come off as so scouse.
Exactly. So I just love the fact that Magical Mystery Tour, that's one of the bonuses of watching that film for me. And I love the fact that they don't feel obliged to have to explain it to an American audience any more than American filmmakers feel obliged to explain American references to the rest of the world, which they don't.
Sure.
You know? So, it's great. And it's actually turned on people like you to
learned a lot about British culture.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, as with so much with the Beatles.
Yes.
There's so much that I know about British slang and you know, comedians and all this other stuff, you know, straight through the Beatles.
Yeah. So that's one of the great things about Magical Mystery Tour. Now, when McCartney says in Anthology that people like Spielberg now like it, you know, I often wonder if that just means, you know, little guys with glasses and curly hair. Because it's people like Spielberg. He doesn't actually say Spielberg.
Yeah, when you say that, he leaves out of it that if, in fact, that we take him at his word that this actually happened, you know, that Spielberg studied it in school or whatever.
Mm.
Yeah, as a negative example, what not to do.
Not to do.
Don't let this happen to you. I mean, what happens when you give a bunch of stoners a film crew.
You know, subsequent to the Beatles' demise, it has got some kind of art house credibility to the film, you know, because it's the Beatles. Now we just make the most of everything we can get of them.
Right. The clout of their Beatleness being the value of it, and of course all the great music that's in it.
Had the Beatles continued as long as the Stones, I don't think we'd be as focused on Mystery Tour, you know, because we'd
it's
have a lot more
finite period.
Yeah.
And then, you know, at 67, a very pivotal year for us. Mm-hmm. One of the last years, like we talked about in the Christmas message show, where they're all four still on the same page, if not the same height that they were in Revolver the year before, it's before things all fall apart in 68.
Right. Now, in terms of the musical sequences in Magical Mystery Tour, I personally love all of them. I could just collate those and be very happy. How do they rate with you? Do you like all of them? Are there any that you think aren't up to snuff, ones that are standouts for you?
Well, okay. In terms of production values, you know, it's interesting that, as I said before, that this was originally scheduled for a two-week shooting period and 2 weeks of editing, all in the month of September. It's not until the very end of October that Paul gets around to – he takes off to Nice, France with Mal Evans and a camera guy, manages to charm his way across two borders without his passport to get in there because he has got this idea that he's going to act upon, which is to go to the hills, going literal for the song Fool on the Hill.
Yeah.
He's going to be on a hill.
And by the way, the footage that is in the extras on the DVD and Blu-ray fantastic footage. I mean, obviously, there's only so much they could use.
Right.
But there are bits there where Paul's just walking there in the south of France and people don't recognize him. It's early morning or something, you know.
Right. They've got they timed it to be there at sunup.
Fabulous.
And they said as the day went on, the light became less and less, you know, aesthetically pleasing. But but they captured something there. It cost them £4,000 to film that whole thing.
Yeah, which is a lot of money back then.
Yeah, it's a big chunk of the budget for the entire film.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a standout because it is so pure. You know, it actually works very well for that song.
I agree. As I said, the only bit bugs me is when he's looking over his shoulder from the hill, looking up, and the camera just briefly goes out of focus and comes back in. And I know a lot of people may think, oh, that's charming, that's great, I love it. Yeah. It's just amateur time for me. I just don't like
it. Are you kidding? That was a lesson to Spielberg. That's how you do it. Yeah.
That's where he learned the dolly zoom shot.
Nobody seems to like him. They can tell what he wants to do. And he never shows his feelings. But the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round. Sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round. Oh, round, 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 round.
Oh. I always liked the Blue Jay Way sequence.
Yes.
And I know some people think it's kind of static, but then the song itself is sort of monochromatic.
No, but it's wonderful because the bit on the rocking horses looking at the screen.
Yeah.
And the bit shot in Ringo's garb.
Sunny Heights.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those were, as I found out when I was doing some research, those were late additions, were filmed much later. In fact, that was one of the very last things filmed for Magical Mystery Tour was the Sunny Heights sequence.
Right.
Because when they originally cut, you know, at the West Malling, he's in the car park on the ground with the chalked out keyboard.
Yeah.
The song was unfinished yet. They hadn't added the cellos yet.
Right.
And once they did, because all they had to that point was George from different angles.
Yes.
The sort of fly lens of him, you know, just various, you know, multiple images of him at once. And then there's the projection of like the leopard face on him.
It's kind of charming now, isn't it? Knowing what can be done now in film, you know, even on your laptop computer, it's just kind of, he's just like moving his hands while flowers are being projected onto him.
Yeah, or the projecting the film onto Mel Evans' bare chest.
Yes.
Why they didn't use Jan Carson at that juncture, I don't know. But
Mel's chest was just a smoother screen, that's why.
Well, it was bigger. Yeah. It was widescreen. But they had to add the cello parts at Sunny Heights just to sort of match the song more.
John's playing of the cello.
Yeah, he's wearing that big sunflower thing on his chest.
Just with the bow sort of pointing it outward. So one sort of, you know, thrust of the bow and then point with it.
Yeah.
But, the bit I love as well is just the other three with the football.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, you never see Beatles in a sporting context.
No,
okay?
Doing anything remotely athletic.
And you see where it's not the forced humour and it's not the supposedly funny lines written by one of them, and it's just them mucking around there.
Let's be natural.
It. Yeah, exactly,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's great. It's very, very charming. I also like the, I suppose I only had about £5 left in the budget for special effects. They got the sort of fireworks at the bottom of the stairs.
Well, that would have been, you know what, as they filmed that, they would have had access to that because Guy Fawkes Day was coming up.
Right, 4th of November.
Right, and this was like November 1st or 2nd that they filmed this. So
they went and got their standard or Brock's fireworks, names that people in Britain would know.
Yep.
Get their box of fireworks. But it's just like some cheesy, cheap little fireworks down there. It's not exactly the end of, what's the Hitchcock film with Cary Grant and Grace Kelly where they kiss and you see fireworks explode across the sky to catch a thief.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite on that scale. It's like a couple of sparklers or something.
You know, and they would say, oh, we were just satirizing the Hitchcock film.
Right.
Well, it only goes to show. I told them where to go. Ask a policeman on the street. There's so many that to me.
And of course, Walrus.
Yes, wonderful, wonderful sequence.
Yeah, one of my favorites for sure. And it's just funny, you know, got John at the white grand piano.
Yeah.
4 years before Imagine.
Right.
Which they would then, you know, riff on that.
It's just wonderful to see. We get a Beatles song presented by the Beatles. There's no director, no writer here. This is them scripting.
Michael Lindsay Hogg.
Right. It's how they want their song to be conveyed.
Yeah.
And even within the limitations of their filmmaking expertise, such as it was, and, you know, the production values, the limited production values that we've already discussed, they do a really fine job with that video.
They do. I would, you know, my only criticism would be, as has been pointed out by somebody else, it's like a clever kid with a new toy, the way the film is put together in terms of visual effects.
Yeah.
The one where the frame goes from, you know, the bottom of the frame goes to the top.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't care much for that.
Right.
But the editing is generally pretty good on that.
Yeah.
I like the Avro warplane flying overhead.
Mm-hmm.
And they made great use of those anti-bomb walls.
Right.
You know, sort of futuristic set.
Yes.
Yeah, which is really cool.
It is.
It's sad to hear that they no longer exist.
I know.
They were torn down in recent decades. And now I guess it's all development now.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. But yeah, it's a really cool performance sequence.
It is. It's wonderful. They're all kind of on form in that video.
Yeah.
I love the bit when they're all in their caftans just sort of mugging for the camera.
Right, right. Yeah. John's got the kind of eyes rolled back in his head.
Yes. Yeah.
But even the costumes, you know.
Yes.
The rabbits and the walrus.
The
Eggman.
Skin, yes. And the skin on Ringo's bass drum.
Yes.
You know, the psychedelic.
That sort of abstract Beatle logo.
Yeah. The pretty little policeman in a row.
The four hand-holding policeman on the wall.
Yeah.
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 Uncredited.
Yellow man accosted. Dripping from a deep dog's eye. Crawling like a fishwife. Pornographic priestess. Boy, you've been a naughty girl. You let your knickers down.
garden waiting for the sun. If the sun don't come, you get a tan from standing in the English rain. I am the Eggman. They are the Eggman. I am the walrus. Expert, expert, choking smokers. Don't you think the Joker laughs at you? See how they smile like pigs in a sty. See how this night.
And then we've got Your Mother Should Know.
Right. Yeah, there are the Beatles aren't particularly known for their dancing skills. Twist and Shout notwithstanding.
Yeah, Ringo is supposed to be the dancer of the group.
Yeah, the natural dancer, as he showed in A Hard Day's Night. Yeah. But apparently this took hours and hours of rehearsal to get them to do these simple, you know, synced movements coming down the stairs.
Well, you've seen the photos of them in their usual
street
colorful
clothes.
Yeah.
Yeah, going through their paces.
Yeah,
but you know, it's funny the whole thing how it comes off as sort of an homage to the Hollywood big budget MGM musicals.
But it's Paul. This is Paul, right?
You know, yeah.
This is a foreshadowing of Gotta Sing, Gotta Dance.
Yeah, correct. Yeah,
you know, here he is in his element,
exactly.
Gone berserk,
and they went along with it.
They did. Yeah. They did. And
well, how the hell else are you going to end this thing?
It's so funny.
Drive
to
the bus
see
over
them,
a cliff.
See them coming down those stairs, all perfectly synced. I
yes.
love that.
Uh-huh.
It's very, very funny.
Yeah,
and you know, George. George dancing and
right.
swinging his arms. But then what about Paul with the black carnation?
That is the equivalent of him barefoot on Abbey Road.
Yeah.
It is Paul suddenly drawing attention to himself.
Yeah. And then, as if that's not enough, of course, he's got to accept the bouquet of flowers and kind of totally overplay it while the other three are still just swinging their arms.
Yes.
You know, it's quite clear whose song this is.
Right. Whose baby this whole thing is.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And then there he is in an anthology saying, well, you know, I take some of the blame for it, but I'm not going to take all of the
right.
blame.
It could have been me. Production-wise, you know, there's all these stories that have emerged from it. Day two of the shoot, they're headed for Widecombe.
Right.
Whitcomb.
Yeah.
Where they're having the annual summer fair.
Yeah.
And because by this time, they did not particularly prepare for the contingency of being followed by press and fans and onlookers.
Yeah.
So the bus driver is trying to find a shortcut to escape all this.
That's right, because it's absolutely mobbed. Yeah.
And they get stuck on a bridge. So then he has to back up half a mile,
yeah.
And that's the point where John loses it, jumps off the bus, starts tearing all the signs off the thing. Yeah. And that's what, as Neil said, that's what they should have filmed.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. There was the magic.
Yes.
Because John, losing his temper. I mean, it's just a perfect Beatles story.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's so much wasted opportunities throughout. Yeah. But that would have been a good one.
Now, something else that, you know, could have been filmed is what was going on behind the scenes there, because it dawned on me a few years ago that there they are on a 2-week shooting schedule, and they've got all their friends and employees on the bus with them.
Yeah.
But conspicuous by their absence are their wives and girlfriends. And so I'm
by design.
Right. And I'm thinking to myself, the Beatles for 2 weeks. Celibacy, I really doubt it. And it's without going into details, let's just say that they weren't celibate during those 2 weeks. They found people to hook up with.
Well, you know, there's a certain criteria in selecting who gets on the bus. Let's say Jesse Robbins made out. No, just kidding. But yeah, you know, yeah. There definitely were people but that just, were, as I said, in the end of Dr. Strangelove will be selected for their sexual prowess.
Yes. But it was just, it amused myself there when I was thinking, like, there's no way that they're going without, you know.
So. Which ended up being absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Right. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah.
There's a great story that Frida Kelly told years later about this, you know. So she's, you know, going back to day one in Liverpool. She's brought along, and you see her in all the pictures taken on the bus. You see some of the other fan club secretaries as well. But the story she told was that she was told in advance there's going to be a 2-week shoot.
Yeah.
So being a girl, she picked 2 weeks worth of outfits to take on the trip so she'd be fresh. And day one was supposed to be the traveling day, right? So she brings like her worst garment just to wear for traveling, right? Yeah. So the next day she's wearing a Mary Quant outfit, and somebody connected with the film goes, wait a minute, you weren't wearing that yesterday.
Continuity.
And she's like, really? I'm going to be seen in this film wearing my worst outfit? And that
and she was.
Yeah, she absolutely was. Mm. Another story that I came across was Miranda Ward. Are you familiar with her?
Yeah.
She became a BBC fixture. But at the time, she was a sort of up-and-coming journalist, you know, young woman who was connected with like teen magazine print media.
Mm.
And it was that was how she got access to being part of the press entourage, the sanctioned entourage.
Didn't she sort of just state to her bosses that she was going to get the Beatles?
She had made that boast because she'd been doing some stringer work for the BBC.
Uh-huh.
She wasn't actually an employee of the BBC at the time.
Right.
So and they were like, yeah, right, you know, on your way. And so she had no clue how to do an interview or even had any reason to believe she'd realistically access the Beatles.
Mm.
I mean, they were keeping the press at bay pretty much for the whole thing. But as it happened, it was her lucky happenstance that she managed to share an elevator with Mal Evans. And she played her card and he was like, well,
I'm sure he played his as well.
Well, there's that, isn't there? He got her access to George, who was not needed on a particular day in Newquay for a shoot.
Mm.
And so George, once he recognizes how way out of her depth she is, doesn't know how to operate a tape recorder, he takes it upon himself to like, okay, I'll steer you through this. He runs the tape for her. Every time she screws up, he winds the tape back and erases it all so they won't have that in evidence in case she accidentally turns it in, and actually feeds her the questions.
So one has to ask, did George have an agenda there?
Well, that would be the cynical way to look at it. But it ended up getting her not only a slot on the BBC, this aired on Seen and Heard, but she became like this roving reporter that got her own slot.
Yeah.
So George's kindness was the making of her career,
right,
and she never forgot that.
Yeah.
But let's play a bit of the interview because it's actually a really good one. And, of course, it's you know architected by George, but it's actually fairly thoughtful.
And it's during production.
Yeah.
We want everybody to be able to freak out, as it were. But we don't have frightened, you know, some people get a bit frightened when, like, Day in the Life, that record, when the music suddenly goes strange and they don't know what it is. And the natural thing when people don't know about something, they tend to fear it. So we don't want them to be puzzled by what's going on. So this way we can do, you know, it can freak out a little bit. But it's the excuse is that it's a magical mystery tour. We don't have to say everything, otherwise then there's no point in people watching you. And then we may change it as we go along. And if we change it and people are expecting one thing, then they may get a bit uptight, as they say. This part that we've been doing is mainly just to tie the whole show together. Because it's called the Magical Mystery Tour, then this is just a typical coach tour. That anything can happen. You see, that's the difference, because it's magic, then we can do anything. So these parts, these sequences, we just had a few ideas. It's mainly just to show the people getting on the coach and a few little things that happened during the course of the coach trip.
How does it feel to be out on the road again as the Beatles?
Yes, I don't know. I've never really known what it's been like as the Beatles, because you see that the Beatles is still something abstract as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's something that other people see us as the Beatles. And I try to see us as the Beatles, but I can't.
At the beginning, didn't you feel like a Beatle?
I suppose I did, yeah. In fact, I do sometimes. You see, when it's in the midst of all this and people are saying Beatles this, Beatles that, then, you know, I've got to accept the thing that they think I'm a Beatle. I'm willing to go along with it, you know, if they want me to be a Beatle, then I'll be one.
So he does a really good job there of laying out really what their intents were with this film, which is, you know, again, sort of tipping the hand. Don't expect traditional holiday entertainment with this film.
Right.
This is what we're doing. This is what our intents are. Hopefully you'll like it and keep up.
I don't even know that they were aware it was going to be holiday entertainment at that point.
By this point in the shoot, I think they had there had to have been some kind of negotiating, at least ongoing, with the BBC.
Well, the BBC, I think they just took it basically kind of sight unseen. You know, it was like it's Beatles.
Right. And they imagine today.
No,
they want to see a script.
Yeah. Yeah, right. But this was the Beatles. He's like, how bad can it be?
Blank check. Yeah. It's going to draw ratings no matter what, right? So there you go.
Yeah.
So another little charming vignette from the film was it was response to Paul from John, write a scene.
Mm.
Well, I had this dream the other day.
Yes. Oh, God. Yeah. That's a fantastic sequence, actually. Again, I can understand at the time people watching it and just thinking, what the hell? What?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But being Jesse Robbins thinking, what the hell? Being fed mountains of spaghetti with a spade.
Being twitchy.
Being twitchy, yes. The waiter. The hair slicked back.
Yeah, well, it's his dad and it's twitchy, isn't it? It's both of them. If you look at Alf.
Yes.
And Alf had been a waiter.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. So,
but I think the kind of greasy little look is definitely a dig at Twitchy. You know?
Yeah, I think so.
Hello, lady.
He had passed away by this time, I believe, too, from a car accident. Mm,
yeah.
I think it was in 65.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's safely out of the scene.
Didn't see himself immortalized on film.
Right. But John is playing this with such relish.
He is. You know, he's got the manic look in his eyes.
Yes,
with that fixed grin.
Yeah.
It's very funny.
It's a great scene.
It is. And the way she just can't take it, he's just piling it on. Yeah.
And Ira Cutler's got like this endless stream of handkerchiefs he's giving her to dab her face with. Yeah. I love that scene. Yeah. And it's got that sort of experimental music underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
It just, you know,
it's
sort of underscoring that this is a nightmare.
With a bit, the bit when they sort of walk up the steps and there's that cow.
Yeah.
There.
The Victor Spinetti's cow.
Yeah, now we're really into the surreal.
Yeah, for sure. Speaking of music, you know, given that the Beatles would have their designated musical interludes for their own music, you still needed somebody performing on the bus.
Shirley Evans.
Well, how they managed to restrain Paul from wanting to commandeer that role. I mean, they must have like tied him up and bound him. But Shirley Evans, who was the master of the accordion.
Yeah. You know, Shirley's Wild Accordion.
Shirley's Wild, with a song, you know, Lennon McCartney tune.
Yeah.
And this didn't get recorded for the film until mid-October.
Mm.
So you're well past the original shooting schedule, which sort of begs the question, was there a particular need for recording this song that they had in mind, which ultimately didn't make the cut? I mean, I'd love to know what their plans were for using this, and it just didn't end up in the film, notwithstanding the fact that John, who's producing the session in the studio with her, is telling her, this is going to make you a fortune.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it didn't come out, unfortunately. But, you know, it's a great, you know, it's an interesting little tune. And apparently John dreamed it up. It's a Lennon McCartney credit.
Yeah.
Let's hear that and you know, create your own visual in your head as you're listening.
Oh, I will. Thank you.
She was a bit of a looker, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah. Not quite on the Jan Carson level, but...
Well, as far as you know. I mean, you didn't see them doing the same act, so what was behind that accordion? She used to do the black label ads as
yes.
Mabel.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, she had a bit of renown in her own mm-hmm. right to that
yeah.
point. Yeah. So another person that had a clear talent set, and really all you see of her in the film, and you barely see her because they kind of film over her shoulder, is the sing-along. You know, the Toot
right.
Toot Tootsie and
yeah.
Red Red Robin.
Yes. I love that sing-along.
Yeah.
It's just terrific.
It is. It's charming. Starts out with Ringo, I've got a lovely bunch of coconuts.
Yeah.
That's him.
That bit, I also love that bit with Ringo when he takes a swig from the bottle and just kind of collapses forward into
yeah,
the
right.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the film is not without its moments.
No, it isn't. And actually, those moments, even though they're clearly unscripted and... It doesn't hold together 100% of the time, but the scenes between him and Aunt Jessie
yeah.
are pretty funny.
They are, yeah. They actually had a bit of chemistry there.
Yeah, they
yeah,
did.
You would have liked to have seen them developed a little further.
Well, again, if it had been a bit more tightly scripted and didn't have to be just improvised like
yeah.
that, you know, it could have been a bit better.
I would say the same of Wendy Winters.
Mm.
Who wouldn't want to see more of her?
Right.
sadly passed on.
Yeah,
she is.
I know.
It's funny that years later, I didn't realize, but... back in America in the 80s when the A&E channel
mm-hmm.
actually aired arts and entertainment,
yeah.
not the garbage that they've been doing for the last several years or so.
They would, say what you really think about them.
Yeah. Well, they used to air some British programming.
Yeah.
And that was how I got familiar with, you know, and I have no context. I just think, oh, a yeah. British TV show. Brushstrokes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
yeah.
I mean, you know. To me, it was just one more British show
mm-hmm.
at a time when all I really knew was Monty Python and Benny Hill.
Right.
So I tuned in just to absorb a little British culture.
Mm.
And who do I see? But, you know, then calling herself Miranda Forbes was it's like she's in a uniform. She played like a, I don't know if she was a cop or something,
uh-huh.
but it was Wendy Winters.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, that's
yes.
cool.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know how big of a career she had in Britain.
That scene when she's got her napkin tucked in between her breasts.
Yes.
Cameron, so I get a feeling that it might have been one of John's suggestions, having seen his swimming pool scene.
Well, there was actually, you know, Paul is on record talking about how there was definitely some motivations there in who they cast.
Mm.
And I wasn't kidding when I said, you know, because she was busty. He actually says, you know, that was him enjoying the privilege of being a casting director. So you get these women, could you turn around, you know, doing that sort of thing. He was quite frank about that. So
did he have a casting couch at the back of the bus?
It's good to be king. What I also thought was kind of cool was how they would employ Beatle music.
Mm.
You know, where you got that love scene
yeah.
on the beach with
All
Ira
My
Cutler.
Loving.
Yeah, right, yeah. that orchestral version.
That's fantastic.
Now, did you ever...
I love you.
Yeah, right, the Scottish folk. I didn't know this till years later because, of course, I wasn't watching British BBC One in 1967. But apparently they cut that scene, or at least they trimmed it down for the first showing because they thought, you know, these two middle-aged people making like teenagers
yeah.
was unsuitable for their viewers.
Well, you know, in America, there were problems with, you know, Harry Belafonte hugging Petula Clark on
right,
air.
Right,
so
In Britain,
it's just a fat lady and an old guy.
There are standards. Yeah. So it's very interesting. I mean, really sort of underscoring what the times were like.
Yes.
You couldn't even show that.
I know. It's kind of pathetic.
It's crazy.
And as it happens, though, in Britain, you could have mixed race and whatever going on TV and certainly much more sexual references in our shows.
Enoch Powell notwithstanding.
Well, right. And Mary Whitehouse also, you know,
yes.
the sort of clean it all up campaigner.
Right.
But we did have, you know, if you see some of the... which are still on YouTube, some of these sort of plays that would be on British TV in the mid-60s, in 65, you know, in 66.
It's art.
Yeah, and
art
you know, they'll be frankly talking about sexual issues and things like that, which would never make it onto American TV at that time.
Right, for sure.
Yeah.
We're such a Puritan people.
I know.
Yeah, our loss.
That's why you live the way you do.
We've made up for it, though, haven't we?
Yeah. Well, we are right now, yeah.
Yes, we are.
So then we get to Raymond's Review Bar. When were those sequences filmed?
That was filmed in the second week of the shoot.
Yeah.
It was after they'd done most of their stuff the first week in Newquay.
Mm.
So the first day back of shooting the following week, they go to Soho.
Yeah. So Paul Raymond, I mean, he's a well-known figure in Britain as
yeah.
owning the most famous sort of nudie bar at that time.
It was the only Raymond's one licensed for full frontal.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
because, you know, back in the 40s and 50s,
mm-hmm.
when they would have in the Soho area of central London.
Yeah.
they basically weren't allowed to move, the models. They would strip and they had to just stand there. They
like
weren't
they're posing for Skechers?
Exactly.
Oh,
exactly. And they weren't allowed to move. I'm not sure when they got rid of that law, but by the 60s, certainly they had, by the latter part of the 60s.
We are not amused.
Right. And so yeah, the Raymond Review Bar had already sort of gained some measure of notoriety. It would get even more well-known in the 70s.
Well, it was they had like a members-only aspect of it where the celebs passing through town, the Sinatras, Judy Garlands, would have special access.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this was, you know, a pretty salacious thing to, once again, if you're not anticipating this thing's going to be shown on Boxing Day before a family-oriented crowd, you know, what the hell are you thinking? Although, you know, they made sure they had the black censored bar across her breast.
And I've never seen footage without that black censored bar.
No. Well, I take in the extras on the Blu-ray. There is.
Oh, is there?
There is, yeah.
Oh, again, something you that
see
you
some
picked up
move.
On, obviously, went straight past me.
Yeah, freeze frame, here I am.
Being, of course, an intrepid and very thorough Beatle researcher, I did once check out the Raymond Review Bar, just, you know, check out the sites where the Beatles had filmed.
Was your bag full of coins?
My dirty grey raincoat.
Yeah, there you go.
But the thing that is kind of interesting is it seemed as one of the more glamorous sort of joints.
Yes.
You know, it's not like some complete flea pit, but it's still got that sleazy sort of feel to
Wasn't that a bit of a hangout for the craze?
Yes.
Yeah, I believe I've read that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we were talking, you know, a fairly notorious venue.
Yeah.
For, again, you know, Paul to get this great idea. We got to get this into the film.
I love the scenes, those shots of John and George.
Yeah.
You know, watching. They're just watching.
George wearing that giant jacket, of course. God knows what's going on beneath
it. Isn't John cleaning his glasses at one point?
Yeah, yeah. I think so. Yeah.
and shaking his leg and going, hey.
The great inspiration that they applied to the scene was, you know, they could have done a straight up stripper thing. Right. And I always thought that, you know, once I had a bit of a Beatle history context, you know, under my belt was, you know, a flashback to their Liverpool days when Alan Williams would get them to back strippers.
Janice.
Yeah. Who do they get but the Bonzo Dog band to play Death Cab for Cutie?
I know.
The incongruity of juxtaposing, you know, this Elvis-esque song.
Yes.
Yeah, with this stripper. Wonderful.
It is. Yeah, it's great seeing Neil Innes is there, right?
Yeah.
We know
pre-Ruttles. Pre-Ruttles, yeah. Pre-Ron Nasty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
Vivian Stanchel in the singing.
Right, who, I don't know if everyone knows this, that he's also the speaking voice on Tubular Bells.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but great friends with George, actually, as well as Legs Larry Smith.
And what's that whole bit at the end, which is funny, where he suddenly got the false teeth as he sings the last line?
You know? Right. Pay your fare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is. It's actually a very funny scene. That works perfectly well.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like one of the best conceived moments of the entire film.
And segues straight into Your Mother Should Know.
Yeah. Where it's like, where do you go from there? So let's play out with Death Cab for Cutie, the song which gave its name later on to a band in America years later. Good band, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think I'll check out Magical Mystery Tour again tonight.
There you go. As well, you all should.
Yeah.
Or save us for Boxing Day, the great Beatle tradition.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is Richard Buskin.
This is Robert Rodriguez.
And this has been
Something About the Beatles.
Well, that night, Cutie called a cab. She left her east side room so drab. She went out on the town, knowing it would make her lover frown.
Death Cab for Cutie, Death Cab for Cutie.
Someone's gonna make you pay your fare. The cab was racing through the night. His eyes in the mirror keeping Cutie in sight. When he saw Cutie, it gave him a thrill. Don't you know, baby, curves can kill.
Death Cab for Cutie, Death Cab
someone's gonna make you pay your fare. Judy, don't you play with fate, don't leave your lover alone. If you go out of the state, his heart will turn to stone. Bad girl, cutie, what have you done? Slip and sliding down a highway 31. The traffic lights change from green to red. They try to solve, but they both wound up dead.
Death cab for cutie. Death cab for cutie.
Someone's gonna make you pay your fare. Someone's gonna make you pay your fare. Someone's gonna make you pay your fare.
Something About the Beatles, produced at Studio Media Recording. Engineered by Scott Steinman. Executive producer, Rick Way. Title song, by The Corgis.
Didn't get across to a lot of people. Does that fact alter your opinion of it? Do you say, right, it seems to have failed, or do you still think it's precisely as good as if people had said it was very good?
Yeah, I think it's as good, you know, as I always thought it was. But when we were making it, I think all of us thought, well, this has got a very thin plot. You know, we hope this idea of doing a thing without a plot works, because the one thing we're going to be able to say is it hasn't got a plot. But, you know, we thought, you don't need a plot. You don't always need one, you know, because, like, the things you did today probably didn't have much of a plot. So?
Oh, I was plotting all day.
Yeah.
But, no, I can see that. But would you call it a success or a failure, this, today?
It's both, you know, it's a success, failure, you know. You can't say it was a success, you know, because the papers didn't like it, and that seems to be what people read, you know, to find out what's a success. But I think it's all right. I think the next one will be a lot better, and it'll have a fat plot. Oh, as opposed to a thin plot.
As opposed to a thin plot. But, I mean, what is success, then? What's a success? How would you define that?
I don't know. I wouldn't try. I suppose, you know, if I don't know how many people liked it, you know, who saw it. I suppose, you know, you could take a...
How many people here liked it?
Oh, there's a few, you know. It wasn't much of a success.
But they like you much more than they like me. But, I mean, well, you've got to watch it again and again on BBC, of course.
17 times.
But I mean, this is the thing that comes back, this seems to be a fascinating thing about any work of art or anything. Can it be a success when people don't like it? It can still to you.
Yeah,
what matters most to you?
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, it obviously matters. If this morning we'd have woken up to find fantastic reviews and everyone said, wow, it's the greatest thing ever, then we would have all said, well, it's a success, you know, and I wouldn't have been on tonight, David. But it doesn't matter all that much, you know, because people said about some of our records, like Strawberry Fields and I Am the Walrus, to name but two, they said those are terrible, you know, it's terrible, you can't do that. You can't talk about letting knickers down on telly, you know. You can't say it. But you can. You know, I've just done it. And it's all right, you know, because especially in about a year or two, I think these things that didn't look like successes will look a bit more like successes, you know, as people get into that kind of thing.